Hello, and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate, one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
At some point in your career, a reporter will likely call you for an interview or invite you to appear on television, radio, or a podcast, or contribute to a print article. This is an important opportunity for you to let the public know more about your specialty area, the latest research findings, or an issue of particular concern to you as a systemic therapist. You want to accurately represent your beloved profession to the public, but where do you begin, especially if you haven't had any media training? The aim of this episode of the AMFT podcast is to highlight how MFTs negotiate and utilize available media opportunities. The spirit of the message today lies in the ethical foundation provided by the AMFT Code of Ethics. Our experts, Dr. Shay Thomas and Dr. Paul Hokemeyer, believe that MFTs should approach media engagement cautiously, as they say, with one foot grounded in ethical standards of our profession, the other foot grounded in our area of clinical competency, with our eyes focused on advancing the well-being of the public we serve and this specialized field of MFT systemic therapy with we are privileged to practice. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest today. Dr. Shay Thomas is an Atlanta native. She's a DMFT and an LMFT with over 20 years of experience as a systemic therapist. Dr. Shay's specialties include emotional intimacy, grief work, spirituality, and holistic wellness. She wears many hats, but as a strengths-based therapist, she is compassionate, curious, collaborative, and creative, and she has a wealth of media experience, including a reality television program from about a decade ago that she will tell us about today. Dr. Paul Hokemeyer is a JD and a PhD. He is the founding principal of Drayson Muse and author of Fragile Power, While Having Everything is Never Enough, and Fragile Power 2.0, Wealth, Narcissism, and Mental Health. That's his latest book. And it's a leading resource for individuals, couples, and families of wealth seeking culturally respectful and clinically effective mental health services. He's a member of the AAMFT, and he's also a member of the American Association of Addiction Medicine. Prior to graduating from the Harvard Medical School Global Leaders in Healthcare program, Paul studied the use of digital technologies at the Yale School of Management. His research in the realm of wealth and mental health has been peer-reviewed and published in many places, including the Journal of Wealth Management. He's also been featured in a number of mainstream media outlets like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, CNN, and Men's Health. Shay and Paul will tell you about their journey into media competency and their careers in educating the public about MFT, as well as how they met. But they are part of a larger project that we will be mentioning multiple times on the podcast throughout the rest of 2024. And is the MFT Systemic Ethics Textbook. It's set up to be the premier text for our profession, assisting marriage and family therapy graduate students, as well as seasoned clinicians to enhance their ethical skills to better serve clients. It is a who's who of MFTs writing on all different types of ethical topics. It came out earlier in the year and is edited by Christina Brown. You can pick it up on Amazon, or you can get it directly, e-version from the AMFT. We will be back after our
enjoyable talk with Paul and Shay. Paul and Shay, welcome to the AAMFT podcast. This topic is one that is often requested. How MFTs present themselves in the media, what you need to know to be prepared to ethically and credibly represent yourself and the profession. I'm so excited to have you all here. If you're listening to the show, the first question, we always like to hear the background story of our experts, specifically your therapeutic origin story, how you got interested in systemic therapy. And then when we always have two guests, it's nice, the story of how you guys met and how you got interested in working with the media.
Thank you for this opportunity. My therapeutic origin story, I will be brief because it's a doozy. I started out as a biology pre-med major in undergrad, had way too much fun in New Orleans, Louisiana, took a psychology elective, fell in love with it, told my family I wanted to change my major from biology pre-med to psychology, and fast forward, ended up going along that route. I did not know there was such a thing as marriage and family therapy until I was done with undergrad and trying to figure out what graduate program I wanted to attend, and stumbled upon it and loved the philosophy, realized I had been slanted that way from the start in terms of not really thinking as much about pathology, but more about strengths and resources and family dynamics as opposed to more intrinsic types of things. So here I am.
You know, it's interesting. I have a similar trajectory too. It's rather long that I will try to make brief. I started my career traditionally. I was an economics major in college, went to law school, became a lawyer, decided that I didn't really want to do that. Looked at the trajectory of big law and decided I wanted more experiences than that. Went into the field of social justice philanthropy, started working for the Human Rights Campaign in Washington, D.C., and then went into the environmental justice movement. Ended up at Greenpeace International in Europe. I was living in Europe. September 11th happened, and I had an existential crisis in my life and moved back to America. Just started working with one of America's wealthiest families, doing concierge lawyering for them. And in that family, there was an acute mental health issue that was not being properly addressed. Became fascinated with that because I was taught that money, if you have enough money, you can solve all your problems. In the field of behavioral health, that wasn't the case at all. Went back to uni, did a master's degree in clinical psychology, and just fell in love with the work. I never thought that I'd practice clinically, but I had to in order to graduate from the program, and realized that I needed additional education. So I went back to school and I did a PhD and studied, focused on identity constructs. So how our identity manifests our intrapersonal, interpersonal, and social cultural well-being. So the lens through which I view the work has a very distinct systemic approach that while, yes, we are individuals, but we live in relationships and we live in a contextual frame. And we've really found that the field of marriage and family therapy addressed that, looked at the systemic influences that impact our holistic well-being.
And how did you all meet, and then your interest in working with the media?
So I was asked to do a reality show over 10 years ago before it was as popular as it is now. And I remember reading some of Dr. Paul's articles on addiction and wealth, because this particular show was a reality show for some celebrity families. And so fast forward, I reached out to him via email and he was so gracious to respond. And I asked some questions about the article. And then I ended up writing an article about my experience in 2014 for Family Therapy Magazine. And we've just stayed in touch over the years since then.
Yeah, that's basically how I remember it. I do remember I was doing work for the Dr. Oz show at the time too. And I think, Dr. Shay, that's how we had a conversation around that and my experience in working in that particular format. And we've just remained kindred spirits. And I have an enormous amount of respect for her work and how she approaches the work. And yeah, and then this came up. I'm not even sure how the opportunity came up to write this article. I think, Dr. Shay, you reached out to me and said that we have this opportunity and would you is this a project that we can finally work together on? And I was all in.
Absolutely. I try to stay active with AAMFT and write articles for Family Therapy Magazine from time to time because I love the flexibility to have the popular press slant and general public feel, but also with the literature background. And the opportunity came up where I believe one of the editors or one of the universities put a call out for people who had experience working with the media. And just between the things that I've done in Atlanta, whether it be for the local news or the newspaper or different popular press magazines, I wanted to pair that with the wide variety of experience that Paul has done, which I admire as well on a lot of different fronts. And I thought it would be a great opportunity to work together.
And it was, for me anyhow.
And it's a great addition to the AMFT Systemic Therapy Ethics Textbook. This is a podcast for those that are interested in presenting the profession on a larger scale and various media platforms. And you all have a wealth of experience, and I have been doing that for a while too. So let's start with the benefits of MFTs working with the media. What do you all think the major benefits of more systemic therapists getting involved with different media outlets?
I believe that media involvement offers systemic therapists an opportunity to advocate for the profession. Obviously, protecting the public when you think about ethics in particular is crucial, but it really, whether you're doing something for local news or having a chance to write an article or even be featured in an article for a magazine or being on a reality show or broadcast television, you have an opportunity to not just promote the profession, but also promote the systemic principles that are very much an integral part to our training. And it really helps normalize that aspect of mental health in general, but also planting seeds for systemic considerations, which is a little bit different from how some people think. And whether it's social justice, whether it's family dynamics, you just get a chance to be that voice and advocate in that regard as well. So reducing stigma, raising awareness about family dynamics and systemic concerns on many levels.
Yeah, I can just add to that by saying that it's important for us to be part of the conversation around mental health writ large, that if we look historically, the field has continued to evolve, that there was a time when it was only psychiatry that could practice in this field, and then psychologists came on board, and then geographically licensed clinical social workers on the East Coast. And then the field of MFTs really grew from the West Coast, and it's been a more recent addition to the field. And with the expansion of disciplines, there's been an expansion in theoretical models and basing, as Shay said earlier, all of our work needs to be grounded on empirically based evidence. The delivery system, though, is quite different. And working systemically with a family, that delivery system is quite different than working with a psychiatrist or working with a psychologist who's just focused on a one-on-one relationship. So not that one's better than or less than, it's just that there are many roads that lead to Rome. And I think the public needs to be made aware of those.
We have many listeners to this podcast, many are MFTs, others are just interested in systemic therapy, working with couples or families. But I think one of the things also that's very important is to distinguishing some of the myths with MFTs. MFTs is now, as we've also branded things through AMFT, as systemic therapy, what it means to be systemic. Plenty of MFTs work with individuals. It's a relational way of thinking about the people in their context. I remember the importance of distilling down what is the core of what it means to be a systemic therapist. But a lot of times the general public does not know what an MFT is, or their view of it is somewhat limited. So in addition to what you all said, I do think it is a mission of many people that are presenting the profession to the public to do a good job clarifying what that is. If you had to explain in your quick elevator speech, if you had to explain what an MFT, what a systemic thinker is, how would you do that in a very quick soundbite?
I would say that it's looking at a person's mental health in the context of their lives.
And I would say similarly that it's not focusing on individual deficits or pathology. It's honoring the influence of context and culture and all that brings, and honoring multiple perspectives and nuances.
Great. Succinct. I love it. So we talk about the benefits, but to do this work, if you're not well-trained and prepared, there's potential constraints or negative consequences of working with the media. What do you think some of those are? We don't want to scare our listeners off, but we also need to talk about the other side of the coin.
Sure. I believe that the risk includes people generalizing what you are presenting. We live in a world where sometimes people lean towards the cookie cutter approach. And so not everyone is attuned to the cultural nuances. And so sometimes it's the soundbite that comes out and the context is lost. And sometimes there is a question of, is this for educational purposes or insight, or is it more for entertainment or shock value? And so that brings to mind not only the exploitation, potential exploitation of the people involved, but your professional reputation and even things like lack of influence in the editing process. Because again, our profession and training is in the mental health arena, and theirs is in whether it be media or marketing or advertising or journalism. And so sometimes you have to make sure you at least have a foundation of certain principles and ethical considerations, hence the chapter.
Yeah, and I would add to that my thoughts as a former lawyer, right, where we need to make sure that we're operating within our scope of competence based upon ethical, clear ethical standards. And there are HIPAA concerns, there's confidentiality concerns, there's concerns about clinicians using their patients as narcissistic supply to enhance their reputation or their sense of importance in the field. And this isn't about us as clinicians. It isn't about our reputation, or what is about our reputation, but it isn't about enhancing our reputation or in a way that puts us out as being celebrity therapists. I think that it's a very slippery slope. And that's very seductive, because we live in a media saturated world, and we live in a social media saturated world where it's all about veneer and it's not about substance. And so I think that we need to stay true to our values and to the values of our profession as MFTs, and maintaining integrity in the work and making sure that we're not using our patients for our own professional or financial advantage.
Since you're talking under the ethical umbrella of exploitation, which is the focus of the text from AMFT and your chapter, let's talk about the important ethical, legal dimensions of this work.
Yeah, when this is one of the elements featured in the chapter, when you look at ethical decision-making principles and our aspirational core values, right? Those general guidelines that appear before you get to the code of ethics sections, if you will. And so those core principles of autonomy and beneficence and justice and fidelity and those kinds of things, that applies not just when we're working individually with clients, but in the media as well. Autonomy is huge, because a lot of times people involved with the media are bound to certain contracts. And if you're coming in as a third party, you want to ask yourself questions around the client's choice about this kind of engagement. And then, of course, clarifying the scope of practice and your role. You want to think about doing what good for the client or the person. And so are they aware of the influence? Are we aware of our influence as speakers or professionals or therapists, whatever our role is? And are the clients aware of the extra attention that might come from the publication or the broadcast, if you will? When we think about doing no harm, to your point about exploitation or the appearance even of such. And so assessing for things such as professional objectivity and dependency. To Paul's point, we live in a world where it's not just media saturated, but sometimes we have providers and professionals that now aim at being this celebrity figure. And as we commonly like to say, no shade on that, but there are still some guidelines that we have to follow as it relates to ethical principles, fairness and addressing bias and those types of things. And so honoring the public trust is key. And we certainly have guidelines and principles for that reason that we should and must abide by.
And I think, too, from a practical standpoint, our interests as licensed clinicians are not always aligned with those of producers and reporters. Shay, you know this as well as I do. So typically what will happen is I'll get an email from a reporter from some publication saying, oh, we're fascinated by your work, and there's a lot of compliments in terms of work and all of that, and we're doing a story on X, Y, and Z. Would you be able to comment? Get back to the reporter, say, yeah, tell me what you're thinking about. Conversation continues on, and then all of a sudden they ask, can you provide a client that I can talk to? That's a non-starter. No, I cannot do that. And typically what they really want, or they really want access to our clients. And there's under no circumstances could I ever say, oh yeah, I had a client that I worked with and she's perfect for this story and here's her name. And so we have to be very careful that we don't fall into that trap. We also need to be aware, as Shay mentioned earlier, that if it is a reality TV show, or if it is an ongoing documentary or whatever, I've been approached for documentaries to do, and we don't have the final say in the edits or any control over the production. And so we may show up and we may present and give sound bites and all of that. How those sound bites are edited and how those are put together in the final product could be very different from what we were promised and what we were told. So I always approach this very cautiously through a lens of great caution. And from a practical standpoint anymore, if a reporter reaches out to me, the only way I will do an interview with a reporter now is by email, because that way I have a record, it's in writing. Truthfully, I can be more thoughtful in my responses. So it's really a win for everybody, but you need to be very careful in terms of what you say, because even if you are extremely careful, it can still be edited in a way that comes across as unflattering or makes you wish that you had never done it.
The other thing is you have to be comfortable setting boundaries, just like we need to be comfortable with setting boundaries in our professional business, whether you work in an agency or private practice and in your personal life. You don't have to accept every opportunity. And even if you're in the midst of an opportunity, you can guide the conversation. I've been live in a local news type situation and have been asked to chime in on something that may have come out as taking sides about a particular story. I can reframe that and I can redirect in a way that focuses on the issue and not the person, or focuses on still just having a certain level of decorum and respect and grace and professionalism. And so even if you're in the midst of, and thankfully I've had the opportunity to work with some media professionals that were pretty, very respectful of boundaries and accepting and understanding that, hey, I'm not willing to risk my professional career for 5 minutes of fame or 2 minutes on the news or my name in this story. So you have boundaries is key. And even if you don't know the reporter, the journalist, you can still respectfully redirect and reframe an opportunity.
And I think Shay brings up something really important too, is evaluating the short-term benefit for the long-term cost. And so a lot of these people, the reporters, they're constantly working. They're on a 24-hour news cycle. And so they're just constantly trying to fill lots of space with 2 or 3 minute soundbite stories. And is it worth it, right? Is it worth it just to go in and give a soundbite if there's the potential that could be put in an unfavorable light?
Paul, as somebody that has worked a lot, both in live TV and also in print media, I actually, people are like, this isn't live TV make you nervous. I would work on NBC affiliate, a midday call-in show, 9 minute segment, taking calls. And I liked it because, as you say, Shay, live TV was actually easier for me because it couldn't be edited. I could reframe, I could tie it in. Whereas, yes, in print, it is much more challenging how you're going to be used, or a recorded piece of material, how that will be used. So I think it's a great tip for people out there of replying to an interview. While it may seem more work composing an answer than it is, it's much harder to take your words or thoughts out of context. Also, this idea of setting boundaries, Shay, I think is important. Do you think it is appropriate to ask to see a version of a print story or an article before it goes to press for no other reason than to check the accuracy of the quote, what would you suggest as appropriate etiquette on that?
Surprisingly, I have had the reporter or the journalist offer that to me, not everyone. And it's worked out well because it could even be something as simple as they refer to me having a PhD and I have a DMFT. And so advocating for that and helping people understand the nuances of that, or somebody referring to me as Dr. Shay Thomas, a psychologist from Atlanta, and no, a licensed marriage and family therapist. And so whether it be something related to the credential or whether it be taking a certain quote out of context, I have had that question posed to me. I have also asked if that was appropriate. And on the back end, I have also followed up about a story needing to be corrected. And so that actually is also a part of our ethical guidelines as well, in one of the standards in terms of correcting. And so I have had to do that as well.
There is no credential or kind of manualized training how to represent MFTs in the media, at least I don't know of. We got this question a lot. How would one break into getting opportunities to present themselves and the profession in the media? Everybody has a different pathway in that now, but I know we will get questions asking for tips of, I want to do this. How do I get started in doing this?
Yeah, I think it's different ways to do it. I mean, when I started doing this around 20 years ago when I was in New York City, and I did a training through a Progressive Media Matters, and I started getting placed in CNN and Fox News, and people were coming to me and saying, how could you give commentary to one or the other? And, you know, my position was, well, I'm talking about mental health. I'm not talking about politics. And so that's mental health is a nonpartisan issue. And hopefully it's a connector. And I think it has been a big connector. And once you start in the field, but certainly it's changed. And so that kind of had its own, that just rolled. And I was in New York and a reporter would call up and say, can you be in the studio in an hour? And I would say, yes. I think becoming a thought leader in a niche. So I think LinkedIn has become a very important platform, and using that. But I do think it's important in a field to develop a certain niche. So my particular niche is working with individuals of wealth and how wealth is viewed as a cultural competency in the field of behavioral health. I think there are some websites out there, Haro, Help Out a Reporter Online. Back in the day, that was a good source. Quoted is another site where you can sign up and reporters who are looking for experts will put out a query and you can respond. It's a lot of work because the hit rate, you may submit 10 and you may get one, maybe. But doing things like that, I think it's like anything else. If you want to do something, set an intention and then do the footwork to make that happen. I don't know, Dr. Shay, how did it work for you?
I would say relationships. Once I had the initial opportunity, I think the opportunities after that came from, oh yeah, so-and-so gave me your name and said that they enjoyed working with you and would you be a good fit for this or that? I do appreciate your comment about catering to whatever your specialty area is or your area of expertise, because that goes a long way as well. If you're the go-to person for grief or for children and parenting, one of my specialties is sports and entertainment families, and so as well as grief. And so sometimes when issues or stories come up around that, that's when I get approached. To your point about Haro, they recently changed. Now they're called Connectively. And so it's just a big database of, yeah, people posting, I'm working on this story, that story, give me a pitch. The interesting thing is that sometimes you don't know if you respond to, if they have five questions about a topic and you actually email your responses, sometimes you don't know if it was actually used. Some reporters are really good about saying, how do you want me to, do you want me to tag you on social media or do you want me to reference your website? Sometimes it's just your name and what state you're in. And so every writer or journalist, columnist has a different way that they do it that way as far as print media. And so, yeah, relationships is big, but then going to different sites, getting your name out. You can actually even pitch magazines and editors for magazines or newspapers. Even now with the online digital media as well, there, if you go to the bottom of the website, there's usually a little something in the frequently asked questions around write for us or pitch a story. And so you can definitely do it that way as well.
You can register for your Google alert for your name. So if the reporter does use the story, you'll get a Google alert from Google saying, oh, you were just quoted in this particular article. There's a way to build on that.
Just following up on what you all said, I think relationships do matter. We're a relational business, a systemic therapist, but also many of my, I'm 47 years old, I've been doing this half of my life now, and some of my early media opportunities were from mentors that were too busy to take the media request, but I was available. So the relationship opened the door. And back to Paul's point, being available. We all don't live in major markets like New York or Atlanta. But for me, I was started in Chicago and now I'm in a smaller market in Louisville, Kentucky. But being nimble, being able to be available when a reporter is on a deadline or there is an emerging news story, I think that also helps people get into the door. 25 years ago when I started in this field, again, there was print media. There was TV and radio. And now I think what we have to talk about today, both how to conduct yourself and the ethical perspective too, is people are not waiting for that anymore. They are creating their own media. They are starting their own YouTube channels, their own Instagram. One of my first supervisees, guest of the show and a very high profile of MFTs now in the mainstream, Vienna Farron, became very popular by her Instagram following, which then led to a series of other media opportunities. So people are creating their own media now. Your thoughts on that as far as what to do, what not to do, and the ethical kind of components of being your own media outlet, so to speak.
Definitely a hot topic. I think going back to the foundational principles, revisiting that notion of autonomy and doing no harm and fairness, things of that nature. In this day and age where everybody's a content creator and things can go viral in 2 seconds, I think it's still, what is your intent? What is your professional responsibility? What is your scope of practice? And so those are some very important things to think about, especially in this day and age, to your point where you don't have to wait on a journalist or a publisher or an editor. You can hop on any platform or your own website or blog and just create, whether it be a video or a written post. So definitely just being responsible in that, always consulting. I think sometimes we minimize that kind of ethics 101 principle, consulting with a professional about everything and getting other professionals in the field's opinion. You may have the marketing or the journalist perspective on how to get hits, right? But you want the professionals and your colleagues' take on ethical guidelines as well.
Yeah, and I think also to add to that, things can go viral and instantly, or they can never go viral. And so, you know, there's an enormous amount. There's been a democratization of the media, and legacy publishing and legacy media is dying. And there is this whole new media that's coming up. And before, say, we had like ABC, CBS, and whatever, four channels. Now there's an infinite number of channels that are out there. And I think the question becomes, for me anyhow, personally and professionally, is what am I willing to give up? How much of my time, how much of my energy, what's the brand that I want to put out there? And what seems to really catch people's attention is controversial media and salacious media and media that is not consistent with who I want to be as a licensed mental health professional practicing in a very esteemed field of marriage and family therapy. And so it's being clear about what you want your brand to be and who you want to be as a licensed mental health professional who has a fiduciary obligation to attend to the mental being and relational well-being of other human beings. And it's not the same for everybody, but it needs to be clear in your mind. And for me in particular, I've had to focus on one particular platform, and I quite like LinkedIn. because I think that there's some professional integrity. I think that there's a level of decorum. I think that you can provide content that is empirically based, but has a personal view on it. I like the fact that the posts, whilst they tend to be a lot of, oh, I just got this promotion, or I just got this job, or I just spoke at this conference, there's also a lot of really good substance. And you can spend an hour and a half and create a post that 500 words, like a short essay on a particular topic, that is, in my view, it's enhancing the field, it's enhancing the level of thought leadership in the space in a way that doesn't have you, I don't know, with your belly button showing or like hanging out of a car window or something like that. So I think that it's picking a certain platform that suits your personality and it suits the audience that you want to reach and then going with it.
I think that's interesting because I think about my experience on LinkedIn and how I use it, but then also how I utilize other platforms. And even though there's so much to learn and there's always something new, one of the things I appreciate about some of the other platforms, whether it be Facebook or Instagram, is you may be able to, as a narrative therapist would say, fight against the dominant discourse of something and advocate in a way to show that, yes, even though this platform is a little bit different and can often feel like the Wild West, I can be civil and I can be compassionate and I can model how to utilize it for inspiration and information instead of comparison or demeaning and demoralizing people. To your point, Eli, earlier about content creators and people choosing to go that route instead of waiting for other people, I think you also have to be thoughtful and intentional about how you respond on social media. So it's not just what you put out, but how you're responding to other posts or even your internal response to the comments and things of that nature, whether it be YouTube or Facebook or Instagram or whatever the case may be, because that's another element of your digital footprint, as they say.
Dr. Shea, you posted during the pandemic, during the lockdown of the pandemic, when we were in the throes of the Black Lives Matter movement and the world was falling apart and the apocalypse was here. You posted a picture, I think it was on Instagram, of your son out playing in the park. And that was such an inspirational post for me. It was like, it told this completely different narrative that I still think about it to this day. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you for that. And I think you raise a very good point about putting a human face on our work. I also like Instagram because I think it does enable me as a clinician to show my humanness and like my point of view in the world. And I ground my work on feminist theory and that I am not the white privileged male who's coming at this as an authority, but this is a collaborative process, that the therapeutic process is collaborative and collaboratively we come up with a solution. And if I want to know your humanness, then I think it's reasonable for you to want to know my humanness. And it's moving away from the typical old school psychoanalysis where the clinician is the expert and has the answers and makes the diagnoses and controls all the power, that this is a co-created reality that's collaborative. And so I think that I am mindful of, there are no belly buttons, at least I hope not, on my Instagram account. But at the same time, it does allow us to show the softer, more human side of who we are.
What you said, Shay, resonated with me in the sense that if you are a content creator and you're putting your own stuff out there, there are pros and cons associated with that, but it gives you the chance to interact with your fan base or people you're educating, but then you have the responsibility to interact with them in an ethical way that many times in social media, I call it keyboard courage. Somebody would respond to you in a way they wouldn't face to face. And how do you deal with people that don't agree with what you're putting out there or even hostile toward you?
So if I think back to when I did the reality show in 2013, I wrote about that in the Family Therapy magazine article. I literally had people, general public and some colleagues saying, oh, you work with those people, you did that show. And in the same way that I don't respond to everything that comes up, or I don't even read all the comments. I'm more of a like a peekaboo kind of social media person. I'm not like a scroller for X amount of hours a day. I post what I need to post, say what I want to say, and then move on to something else. But it's just developing thick skin, but also standing your ground when you need to. So yes, the comments, the critique will come. And as long as you're standing by your own morals and values and ethical principles, you don't even have to defend everything or address everything when it is a different perspective.
I don't pay that much attention to it. Like when I do take my professional reputation very seriously, and I do have some soft skin, but I fortunately, I haven't had a lot of hostility about my work or what I say. So I can't really, I haven't had a situation where somebody says, Hochmeyer, you're an idiot. Take that down. Although I have had people say something like, you should probably take that down. And I had to think long and hard as to like, why and what's this in you? And you're certainly entitled to opinion. And what is it about you that needs you to control what I say? And so having some thoughtful conversations around that, and that's personal growth and that's professional growth. And that's being clear about what we're doing and why we're doing it. And is it consistent with our brand? And yes, I am entitled to an opinion and things like that.
You guys have such a wealth of experience, and a lot of times we learn by doing. Do you have any other good stories about what the media taught you, important lessons of what to do and what not to do for our listeners? Any other helpful tips that you learned through experience that you want our listeners to know about?
One that comes to mind for me is that you don't have to borrow the pace of that industry. Sometimes it's very, the deadlines are so quick and you feel rushed. Again, you can decline. You can say, I can't get it to you Friday by 4, but what about Saturday by 3 or Monday by 8? And so sometimes if you are very eager to participate, but the timelines don't line up, you don't have to let the anxiety take over with that. Of course, that's separate from is the issue even something that you're qualified to speak on and feel like you can be a fair and just representation for the profession. So those are two things that immediately come to mind, like staying within scope of practice and being mindful of pace and the time factor.
I guess for me, it would be more about doing the legwork, but don't get too attached to the outcomes. I think probably the most valuable thing that I have gotten from it over the years is that I've learned so much about such a wide, diverse area of like topics. A reporter will reach out and say, do you have any thoughts on X, Y, and Z? And you go online and you do some research and you learn about X, Y, and Z. And then you give it back to the media in a way that through a systemic lens and that's relevant to our work as marriage and family therapists. And so for me, it's been this constant learning experience, which I think all of us who are in this field are in the field because we're just fascinated by the human experience and learning. It's constantly learning. We're learning about ourselves. We're learning about our clients. We're learning about the world that we live in. And so it's a way to enhance this learning process. And to me, it's been really a fellowship in learning more and more about mental health and wellness and holistic wellness.
Well, and the way we started, what you just said really resonated with me because many times this news event happens or this tragedy and an MFT is called, and I've certainly been in this situation many times. I'm not an expert on the content, but what we are as systemic thinkers, we know relational, individual, couple, and family process. So many times we, as you just said, Paul, we are using our critical thinking and putting our systemic lens on the content they are asking us to respond to, and which I think is a great way to think also about how to approach this work. I'm so glad you all have been with us today. Your websites are both excellent. Please here at the end, plug anything outside of this currently you want our listeners to know about. And I know, Shay, we're going to have listeners ask what the name of the reality show was if you're comfortable sharing that, because you can find anything now, even if it's 10 years old. People will find
yes,
it and want to look
can.
At it.
I was on a show called R&B Divas. filmed in Atlanta in 2013.
Would you ever do reality TV again as a talking head, systemic therapy perspective?
If the producers and directors have the same type of professional respect that company did, it was through TV One. I went into this with my article. I pumped the brakes and I was like, okay, let's talk about my consent form. Let's talk about my orientation to the clients in this regard or the third party. And let's talk about the goal. So because I had a good experience with them, I would consider doing it again. I have turned down multiple opportunities since then because they were not a good fit. When I think about Satir's notion of congruence, I think that sticks with me and stands out about who I am. What are my moral, ethical, spiritual principles? And are people going to respect that? And if not, then I'm bowing out. I'm not going to, again, sacrifice the exposure, sacrifice my reputation or morals or values or ethical guidelines for that kind of exposure. So
I think that's great advice. How do people contact you guys? They want to see more about you. Please feel free to plug anything you'd like here at the close.
Sure. My website is drshayspeaks.org. I am Dr. Shay Speaks on Instagram and Dr. Shay Live on Facebook.
And you can find me on LinkedIn, Dr. Paul Hochmeier, Hokemeyer. And just put it in. There aren't many Hochmeyers around. So if you Google it, you'll find more than you would ever want to know.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. For the first time in several years, AAMFT face-to-face, the Systemic Family Therapy Conference at the world-famous Walt Disney Swan and Dolphin Resort, Orlando, Florida, November 4th through November 7th. It's coming up soon, my friends. If you have not been a part of the Systemic Family Therapy Conference in its online format the last few years, which has been wildly successful, you'll definitely want to join this year, as this is a comprehensive event providing systemic thinkers with personal and professional development, cutting-edge clinical skills and training, and a chance to see your friends again that maybe, if you're like me, you only see once, or if we're lucky, twice a year. And in a post-pandemic world, it's been longer than that for me. In the origin of the podcast, that's where I would conduct a lot of face-to-face interviews. Go to amft.org, register today, the Systemic Family Therapy Conference, Orlando, Florida, November 4th through the 7th. Did you know that AAMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AAMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AAMFT? You can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcasts and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy, like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including I have two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, a National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors. You want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.